Okay, so yeah, I haven't got a title for this. If there is a title, it's sort of I don't know, going for refuge, work in progress, something like that. So I'll just give you the full quote from the Padmaloka program, and it comes from the Ten Pillars by Sangharakshita, page 21. If you're into those sort of things, well, there's a few scribbles. I like it when people are interested in the references. Okay, so Bhante says, going for refuge or commitment to the three jewels is one's lifeblood as a Buddhist. Observance of the precepts represents the circulation of that blood through every fibre of one's being. By its very nature, blood must circulate. If it does not circulate, this means that the organism to which it belongs is dead, and that the blood itself, stagnating, will soon cease to be blood. Similarly, by its very nature, the going for refuge must find expression in the observance of the precepts. If it does not find such expression, this means that as a Buddhist, one is virtually dead, and that the going for refuge itself, becoming more and more mechanical, will soon cease to be effectively such. It's very, very sort of good, full and rich a quote. I'm not going to say too much about that in a way. Before that, on the same page, Bhante says some other things, which I'm going to read you as well. It's just a paragraph or so. In a sense, going for refuge and the observance of the precepts are part of a single process of spiritual life and growth. When one places the Buddha, that is to say, places the spiritual ideal at the centre of one's personal mandala, a radical reorganisation of the contents of that mandala naturally follows. If no such reorganisation follows, then one's placing of the Buddha at the centre of one's mandala has been purely nominal. Or perhaps what one has placed there is not really the Buddha at all. The placing of the Buddha at the centre of one's personal mandala corresponds to going for refuge. The radical reorganisation of the contents of that mandala corresponds to the observance of the precepts as its natural consequence. That is to say, as the prolongation of the act of going for refuge itself into every aspect of one's existence. Mandala, you know what a mandala is? No, nobody in any doubt about what a mandala is? Good, all right, you're going to find out about that this afternoon, aren't you? Okay. Now, I mean, all that could take a lot of unpacking. And the unpacking could be done in very many different ways. But I'm not really going to do that. I'm going to sort of go off on a sort of sidetrack in a way, I think. And I'll keep checking with you all what you are or are not familiar with, although it sounds like most of you are going to be familiar with quite a lot of this. You have to get used to a more rubbery, bendy meaning of words when you get into Tri-Ratna Buddhism. Perhaps it's something to do with Bhante Sangharakshita's interest in poetry as a higher, more expressive mode of expression than the mere conceptual. Yeah, you have to sort of get used to that. When you read Bhante, I mean, even those things, they're sort of, they're incredibly rubbery, and he's mixing metaphor in with what he's saying, yeah? So it sort of, it reaches in, it touches, I think. Personally, when I encountered Buddhism, I was a mechanical engineering student. And I was used to reading books on metallurgy and, you know, sort of all that kind of stuff, workshop manuals. Not much poetry there, strictly black and white. So I had to really develop a new art. I had to develop a sensitivity, and it took a long time. I can remember the first thing I ever read by Bhante was... Mind Reactive and Creative, and I could sort of see what he meant, but it was a mixture of to me anyway completely obvious and sort of all this sort of rather sickly stuff about the beautiful lotus openings. Like, I couldn't be going with that in those days. It was all, I mean, it was either it's black or it's white, and is it mechanical or scientific or not? So I had quite a lot of trouble with that. So refuge, for instance, is an extremely rubbery word. At the best of times, it applies running away or towards, doesn't it? Being a refugee these days is actually a very loaded term. Running away from? What might we be running away from? Perhaps the madness and chaos, the stupidity of a 21st century urban world. I don't think it's even, you know, that there are urban societies. The whole world has become a sort of urban environment with all this, well, fortunately, hopefully, we've taken away most of your little devices, but that keeps us plugged into the wider world and its madness and chaos. Perhaps we're running towards, with a bit of luck, sanity, peace, meaning and purpose, perhaps a higher purpose. So are we refugees? Yes or no? Yes and no. Discuss, yeah, in your groups. That's quite an interesting little thing to be going into, I think. And notice it's going for refuge, yeah? It's not gone, it's going. So it's active and it's present, as Banti states in his pieces at the beginning. So where does this expression going for refuge come from? Are you familiar with that? Have you come across that before? Nobody's saying, okay. Well, it's completely traditional. It goes back to the Buddha himself. And the Buddha, of course, is the first of our, the prime, if you like, of the three refuges. So going for refuge originates from and through him. Buddha, we know what a Buddha is? Yeah, more or less, yeah, roughly. An awakened one, an enlightened human being, not God, who somehow managed to have a direct experience of reality with a capital R. Yeah? Reality with a capital R. He saw things, the world, life, as it really is. This is how it's often put, yeah? Seeing things as they really are. That's what you see when you awaken. I think in our saner, more peaceful and reflective moments, we can get an inkling, a bit like a shadow passing over us, or like when a cloud passes in front of the sun, an inkling that we do not see things, the world, life, as it really is. Do we? Discuss, yeah, in your groups again. Do we see things as they really are? What would that look like if we did see things as they really are? What would that look like? I think it's almost inconceivable, actually, what that might look like. Unfathomable, almost unknowable. At least in our sort of, you know, feet on the ground, half an ear to the iPhone and all the rest of it. It's going to be very difficult to apprehend at all. The Buddha himself, as an enlightened being, was also almost inconceivable, yeah, unfathomable, very difficult to work out who and what he was. So back to the origin of going for refuge. In the ancient Pali scriptures, Pali is an old Indian language. It's a bit like Latin. It's sort of been preserved because there are lots of old texts in Pali. But I'm not sure that anybody speaks it anymore, but you get Pali scholars. So in these Pali scriptures, Buddhist scriptures, you encounter the Buddha wandering from place to place, begging food as he goes. And then he meets people. The Pali canon as a collection of books is vast. And in the vast proportion of those, You get these little pieces, some of them very long and some of them are quite short. It's just the Buddha in dialogue with somebody. Somebody's met on the road. It might be a collection of his followers. It really sort of depends. And they get talking. Some of them, sometimes it's a merchant, a young man about town. It could be a prostitute, another wandering ascetic from another sort of another bunch of what they call shramanas, wanderers, yeah, somebody else looking for the truth in a different tradition, and they get talking. And sooner or later, the person asks the Buddha a question, perhaps about the meaning of life, or about his teaching, or what happens after death. There's some of the sort of the favourite ones that get repeated over and over again. And the Buddha might reply at great length. He might just say a few words, or he might say absolutely nothing at all. And sometimes there's even a collection where he, it seems a lot of the time, at least in the early part of his ministry, to call it that, he would give voice to an udana, which means breathing out. And he'd come out with a sort of just a line of verse. So he would say, he would give his teaching as a line of poetry almost. Very interesting. We've sort of lost all that now, a long time ago. He might do that. He might give what's called his lion's roar, where he'd sort of, I mean, I don't know if we can take it completely literally, but just like a lion in the jungle, when the lion roars, everything goes quiet. Yeah, they keep their heads down, the other animals, when the lion roars. A full and frank, almost defiant declaration of his great spiritual experience and the path that he teaches. But whatever it was that he did or said, the result was usually the same. The person or people he was talking to felt deeply affected, deeply moved, deeply stirred. Their hair may stand on end, they may shed tears, they may be seized by a violent fit of trembling. They feel as if they're seeing a great light. They have a tremendous sense of emancipation, as if a great burden has been lifted off their back or they've been let out of prison. It's as if, and this is how the traditional referring goes, and it's at the end of quite a number of the Pali suttas. It's as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down, or to point out the way to one who had got lost, or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place. That's what it would feel like. And then the person would break into, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, and then later, when he had lots of followers, to the Sangha for refuge I go. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami. To the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. That's their response. They go for refuge, they commit themselves, because the Buddha's shown them a vision of inner truth, of existence, of life itself in all its depth and complexity. And this vision is so great that all one can do is give oneself to it completely, live for it, if necessary, die for it, at least perhaps surrender to it. Which is interesting. That's one of the meanings of the word sarana, which is as in Buddhang saranang gacchami. Saranang, it can mean surrender, self-surrender even. Yeah. So they just give themselves up. They give themselves up to the Buddha, which is quite something. You must have been incredibly charismatic in a sort of non-charismatic kind of way. Okay, dharma, or dhamma, truth, the way things really are, as I mentioned before, as communicated by the Buddha in words or concepts, behaviour and his demeanour. And we have to bear in mind that the transmission of the truth, like in the Pali texts, the way things really are, can't be fully expressed or conveyed through words and concepts alone. Even perhaps by his behaviour. That helps a bit, but it doesn't give us the whole thing. What we get is the proverbial finger pointing at the moon. Yeah? He's sort of gesturing in a direction. And particularly when you open a book of the Pali Canon, really you're getting a finger that's pointing at something. You have to read it in this rubbery kind of way and ask yourself what else it could mean. You have to keep asking that question. What else could this mean? Because in the long run, what's got to happen is that one has to experience it for oneself in the fullness of time. Very long time, it feels like. Sangha. This is the company of all those who've had this direct personal experience of the way things really are. Note, it's not your local Sangha. It's not your local Sangha. That's composed of more or less ordinary people, messes in progress, as Arloka likes to call them, messes in progress, doing the best they can to become integrated, positive, loving, reliable, dependable through their own practice. Nor is the Sangha refuge necessarily the monastic Sangha. Although when he started off, Bhante just took that as read because that's what the other monks told him when he first got ordained. Oh, this is the Sangha. But he soon managed to see through that. Just because someone's got all the right gear, the right uniform, doesn't necessarily mean anything. Doesn't necessarily mean they know anything. And I think you even have to bear that in mind with somebody who's got one of these, yeah? Okay, they've got one of these. They were effectively going for refuge at some point in their life. They may have dropped off from that 3 hours after they were ordained, yeah? And never got back there, yeah? But they're trying, yeah? They're trying hard. It can happen to you, yeah? You might think, oh, it's, you know, like ordination is the gateway. You know, you'll never fall back. It's not really like that. When you get ordained, the work starts. That's when it really starts, when you get ordained, because you've got something to live up to. Order members have written pieces in Shabda, the Order magazine, about this feeling like a yoke that's sort of, you know, like pulling you down. And sometimes it can feel like that, yeah? So you have to be cautious with all three refuges, especially as they present themselves to you in the moment. Beware unrealistic expectations of individual teachers, individual practices, and collections of practitioners. There's a sutta called the Kalama Sutta, where this particular sort of tribe, they you know, they're really confused because all these different teachers come through and they tell them different things. And I think the expression goes, they pull the legs and wings off each other's teachings. So they take the last person's teaching to bits and then present their own one. So they ask the Buddha, well, how do we tell which is the right teaching? You know, how do we know what to go on? And the Buddha says, well, when you yourself know that these things, these people, these practices lead to dispassion, detachment, decrease of worldly gains, frugality, contentment, solitude, energy, delight in the good, etc., then you can affirm this is the norm, this is the discipline, this is the Buddha's message. Yeah. So, to put it in sort of contemporary terms, Buddhism and the practice of the Dharma is a matter of suck it and see. Yeah, you have to actually put the jacket on to see whether it fits. You can't just admire it in the window. Yeah, you've actually got to stick it in and try it, as it were. Sorry, I get a bit carried away. In shorthand, we can say that going for refuge means commitment. This was very, very common in my early day. I remember when I asked to be a Mitra, I said to one of my Kalyana Mitras, I'd like to be a Mitra. And he said, right, so you want to go for refuge? And I thought, no, I just want to be a Mitra. there was nothing about going for refuge in those days. Commitment I saw as sort of way off, you know, a bit further down the line. But what the hell was going for refuge? I really didn't know. We didn't talk about it in those terms in those days. So yes, commitment in varying degrees to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And there are all sorts of lists of facets, as it were, of going for refuge. There are the six levels. All of these, of course, have been teased out by Bhante. Bhante seems to be the only one who's sort of really thought about and hammered out the different distinctions to going for refuge. I know in one of his biographies, he says that he didn't really get to grips with what going for refuge meant until he encountered his Tibetan teachers in Kalimpong, because the Tibetans do acknowledge going for refuge. I don't think he ever heard his Theravada friends and teachers talking about going for refuge, apart from reciting, you know, the Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, the standard sort of chant. They certainly didn't talk about it, it seems. So, six levels, six facets of going for refuge. I won't say much about these at all. Cultural, provisional, effective. That's theoretically, that's when you get ordained, but we go up and down. We're still messes in progress, even when we get the CASA. Real, ultimate, and cosmic, going for refuge. This is all in, where is this? Is this in the history of my going for refuge, I think? You can read about all this, so I'm not going to go into that. Going for refuge can also be expressed as the five great stages of the path. Integration and positive emotion. You're probably familiar with these again, aren't you? Anybody not familiar with the five great stages of the path? Good, okay. Integration and positive emotion. This is our groundwork. Yeah, it's the accumulation of positive karma and faith, we could say, Shraddha. Karma, we're familiar with karma, are we? Actions have consequences. Yeah, that's all we can rely on, really, is the more and more positive actions we can do, probably the easier time we'll have. Although, as Bhante once said, you never know whether you're a demon having a good life or a bodhisattva going through hell. It's not clear. So you don't know what's in the karmic bank account. You never get to see that. So you might get to the end of your life thinking you've sailed through and it's been wonderful, and no, you're in the red. Yeah. So you can't bank on that. You have to assume that you're already in the red and you've got a lot to do. Yeah. Then there's vision or spiritual death. There's transformation or spiritual rebirth. This is where, you know, your going for refuge is becoming effective. You're starting to really do something with it. And from that comes spontaneous, compassionate activity. Then there are various dimensions of going for refuge. Going for refuge looked at through this or that perspective. You're probably more familiar with these, actually. Real going for refuge. Emotional and volitional. Opening of the Dharma eye. seeing deeply the implications of various teachings, for instance, the three Lakshanas. I won't go into those. Stream entry. Our efforts are beginning to produce real change in our being and consciousness, to the extent that, maybe quite soon they can't be lost. Yeah. And from stream entry, one cannot fall back. Yeah? So that Bhante says this is a realistic goal for current Dharma practitioners. Going forth is another dimension. On account of those changes, we begin to reorganize our lives, reorganize our mandala, as it were, and make lasting changes to how we live and practice. And then there's a rising of the bodhicitta, the altruistic dimension of real going for refuge. This emphasizes the other orientation, the collective and communal, the higher emotional aspect of going for refuge. And it seems, Bhante stresses this in a number of his old talks and in books, we individually don't become, perhaps cannot become, a bodhisattva ourselves individually, but collectively in our better cooperative moments we can become a bodhisattva, or we can behave like a bodhisattva. And this is quite a good thing to do, yeah, because it sets up a creative tension between self and other. And really it's that sort of creative tension between self and other that I want to talk about. Oh dear. So that's quite a lot of theory, quite a lot of lists. It's worth bearing in mind, though, that in the long run, the spiritual life is a lifetime project. Yeah, it's going to take a long time. Hopefully you're in it for the rest of your life. But in the long run, we will need to be familiar with all the lists. We don't even necessarily, I mean, I don't know all the lists, but I know where to find them. Yeah, somebody mentions the four Sangraha Vastus. I couldn't reel them off, but I know where to find them pretty quickly. Maybe that's as good as you can do, especially as an engineer. What we have to bear in mind is that Eventually, all doctrine becomes method. All these lists are actually practical when you achieve a certain level of integration and spiritual maturity. So, what did I say? I said, I was interested in this creative tension between self and other. So, let's see if I can give you some practical hints and tips, as it were. One thing that Banji said quite a long time ago, which I took on board, and it's proved very worthwhile, was that if this or that teaching doesn't seem appropriate or relevant, or even perhaps you don't like it, don't dump it completely. Put it on the shelf, as it were, and come back to it later. Just keep... No, I still don't like it. There might be something in it. Yeah, and you'll find that your attitude to it may change. Yeah, and just like the list, sooner or later, you may find that it's actually practical and it's applicable to your own experience. Like it or not, things are the way they are. Yeah, it's quite an interesting to think about that. I mean, we make up all sorts of stories and all the rest of it. I'll come on to this a bit later, but we think we know the way things are, and we try and sort of hold that together, but actually we don't. We don't really know how things are. That's why I wanted you to talk about it earlier. You know, how are things? What are they really like? What are things like? The process of change can be either integrative and expansive, or it can be disintegrative and fixing. It can be limiting, especially if we don't do anything. Yeah, we just stagnate, and the spiritual being dies. Yeah, the blood ceases to be blood. It stops circulating. Out. So that's what happens when we try to deny or stop change, because like it or not, we are changing. Physically, certainly, we're changing. So stopping or denying change is not really the way things are. That's not how things are. Things are in process. We are in process. Our minds are in process. Our bodies are in process. And we can either let that run, or we can take control of it. As Dana Priya said this morning, you can decide to do something. Yeah, you can make a decision to take control of your life to some extent. Yeah, it's not a big control, and it might take a long time and be a bit of a struggle, but you have actually got a choice. There is always a choice. Now, I've not really mentioned the precepts, all right. Let's see, I'm going to make sure I get things in the right order. I've not mentioned the precepts. You're familiar with these, presumably. The ten precepts, as in Banji's The Ten Pillars that I read from earlier. We chant them along with the refuges in the Sevenfold Puja. Yeah, this is where spiritual practice becomes specific and practical and individual with the practice of the precepts. But I'd just like to just do a little aside here. Spiritual practice. You have to be quite precise with this. Banti's very precise with this. You know, you can pick up lots of magazines, can't you, about spiritual practice, and it's all a bit sort of, you know, shining lights and, the nastier sort of sloppy lotus opening. And we had a magazine here. We every now and again on our at homes, we get it out and leave it on the table, and it's hilarious about all these things that are supposed to be spiritual. It really is laughable, but these magazines sell. People believe this stuff. It's quite interesting. So, definition of spiritual, so that there's no confusion. It's not an ordinary day-to-day consciousness or ordinary day-to-day skillful mental states. The way Banti uses the word spiritual, and I think you have to take this as read for just about anything that anybody in the movement, especially if they've got one of these, says about spiritual, this is what they should be saying, that you're at least referring to skillful mental states, kusala dharmas, as it were, as opposed to unskillful mental states. So that's a choice for a start. Yeah. Do you know when you're in a negative mental state? I think, I sort of came around to that as a sort of an awareness and a decision quite late on. But I think you could make that an immediate goal, especially if you're new. Can I tell when I'm in a negative or positive mental state? And watch it from day to day, moment to moment. What's happening? Yeah. One of the things Banti says is that if you're in a negative mental state, you can't think straight. Yeah. Your thinking will take you down the plug big time. So you've got to be in a positive mental state before you start thinking. And of course, we don't do that, do we? We do a lot of our thinking in negative mental states, and we wonder why everything turns into a sort of a bramble bush. So that's at a lower level. That's this skillful mental states. He also uses it to describe the transcendental, what's called a locutora, or otherworldly mental states. So that's obviously on the way up. Yeah. So any spiritual practice must be a practice that is developing or encouraging skillful mental states, if not transcendental experience. Yeah. So it rules out a lot of the things that we might like to think would be, spiritual. I don't know. I mean, I don't do any of this for. I haven't done any of this for a long time. But, I mean, you might hear people saying, oh, yeah, smoking dope's really spiritual kind of thing. I mean, it might put you in odd mental states, but they're not necessarily skillful, and they're certainly not transcendental. You're out of it, basically. If it's not transcendental, nothing less will do. Yeah, it's got to be pertaining to the transcendental. So, you know, having a nice time with sexual partners, you know, you can't call that spiritual. It may be psychologically positive. You may be able to work some things out doing that, but it's not in the long run transcendental. It might not even be skillful. So you have to be very careful with that. The point about these 10 precepts, positive precepts particularly, is that they are relational. Yeah, we are relational beings. The positive 10 are, and I like the positive 10 because it's not a question of not doing things, it's of actually doing things. It's a much more sort of creative and positive approach, I think. So you've got harmlessness or love. You've got generosity of spirit, you could say, with a small s. You've got contentment. These are sort of body, particularly body, but they can include mind as well. They should include mind. And in a way they do when you come to the last three. Then you've got four speech precepts: to be truthful in your speech, kindly in your speech, to make sure that your speech is meaningful and that it's harmonious. So this doesn't mean that you yourself, make sure that your speech is kindly, meaningful and harmonious, but you make sure that other people are doing that as well. If you hear people larking about and wasting their time on frivolous speech, you go in and you try and make it meaningful. If two people are having an argument, you try and harmonise them, yeah? You don't just do it in yourself, you put it out. And then the last three, very important. Sometimes when we study the 10 pillars, we start with these three because they're in a way, they're more fundamental. You've got, to put them in the positive again, tranquility, compassion and wisdom. Yeah, and these are the opposites of greed, hatred and delusion. And I'd like to refer you to definitions of greed, hatred and delusion, which you may not have come across. This is very old. This is old Bante from a little book called Human Enlightenment. I don't know if you can even still get it. It's in the lecture, The Meaning of Spiritual Community, as well. He talks about these three. Have you heard of these? Not sure. Yeah. Wait and see. All right. So craving, greed, if you like. he describes as a longing desire to possess objects of sensuous cognition which you like and to include them in your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from having them as part of you. Yeah, it's quite complicated, isn't it? But I'll read it again here. A longing desire to possess objects of sensuous cognition which you like and to include them in your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from having them as part of you. That's why we collect things, yeah? We see something nice, we think, oh, right. We sort of plug it into ourselves and that's me, you know, a bit more secure. You know, I'm a bit more there, a bit more real. That's how it feels, yeah? Aversion is defined as fearful and angered repulsion to get rid of objects of sensuous cognition which you dislike and to exclude them from your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from not having them as part of you. That's why we, you know, there are certain people we don't like and we sort of push them away because, you know, if we get too close to them, we might be associated with them and then our sense of security is lessened by this other person. I mean, it's ridiculous, but that's how we operate, yeah? That's how we operate. Do you want me to repeat that one again? Aversion? No. Yeah, aversion, hatred. Fearful and angered repulsion to get rid of objects of sensory cognition which you dislike and to exclude them from your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from not having them as part of you. So you can see they're obviously opposites. Delusion is very interesting as well. I mean, it's easy to think that ignorance is not knowing, yeah? Or that delusion is not knowing. But listen to this. Delusion is defined as a stubborn closed-mindedness about learning anything which you feel might threaten your ego identity, upset the sense of security you wish to get from it, but which you're unaware of and therefore feel you must protect. So it's quite deep-rooted. It's not a conscious thing at all. Very, very interesting. A stubborn closed-mindedness about learning anything which you feel might threaten your ego identity. So we have a sort of nose for this, don't we? Almost a sixth sense. And something, I mean, I don't know, sometimes when somebody walks towards you with one of these on, you think, you know, this is going to upset my sense of security, kind of thing. You're unaware of this, and therefore you feel you must protect it, yeah? So I really like those. I've been running on those for about 20 years, and I'm still finding that very productive. Oh, oh, dear. So as I said, the point about these 10 positive precepts is that they're relational. We are relational beings. Precepts are not about what we do or don't do in the privacy of our own mind or being. They're primarily about how we relate to other people. Yeah. So I think to begin with, if we've sort of got the leftovers of the 10 commandments, we think it's all about me and what I'm doing. But it's how we relate to other people. Yeah. This is fundamentally important. Right, let's try. We'll try a very brief workshop this morning. Take a deep breath. Good. Now look around you. People sitting next to you, behind you, in front of you. Have a look at them. Just have a quick look. Good. Good. Here is our immediate sangha. Other messes in progress. Yeah? Other messes in progress. It's vital that we learn to engage with them as fully as possible, firing on all emotions, vividly alive. I love the way you put that. We're full of energy, yeah? So engage that. Don't block it. Engage it with other people. Whether we like them or not. Yeah, whether we like them or not. When I was thinking about this, I thought a little teaching from Padmasambhava sort of came up. He gives a series of teachings, and at the end of each teaching, he says, without this, no means exists. And I think that's true of this business of connecting with other members of our immediate Sangha. Without that connection, without that engagement, vigorously and full-heartedly, no means exists. Yeah? We're just going to be a private Buddhist. There's that woman, isn't there, in one of Banti's lectures who confides in him one day, "I've been a Buddhist for 20 years and nobody knows." And she's really proud of that. Nobody knows she's a Buddhist, so they can't tell. So what she's up to, heaven only knows. We've got to love, we've got to be generous, we've got to be contented, truthful or honest, kindly speaking, meaningfully speaking, for the sake of harmony, with tranquility, compassion and ultimately wisdom. Yeah, that is eradicating greed, hatred and delusion. We've got to do this with each other and, in the long run, all others, yeah, that we come in contact with. This is the path. This is vital. We can't really become a Buddhist if we're not prepared to die to the old self. Yeah? And the way we die to the old self is engaging with the other, because that will force us to change. We can't really engage with others in a full-hearted kind of way without that having some effect on ourselves. Yeah? This is going to require unremitting, continual effort and exertion. As I say, when we feel like it, and especially when we do not feel like it. Yeah? That's when the strength of our practice really comes into play. Yeah? When we don't want to do it, and we do it anyway. That's what the teaching tells us to do. Yeah, feel the resistance and do it anyway, as the book says. That's going for refuge, yeah? That's what commitment demands, yeah? Can you tell, moment to moment, whether, what mental state you're in, whether you're actually going for refuge? Are you engaging? Can you feel the resistance, yeah? These are all sort of useful questions. I hope I'm not putting any of you off. I had this conversation once with Banti about, how did it go? I'm sure I've written it down somewhere, but... I said, sometimes I talk to people and they get a bit irritated. I try to inspire them. And he said, "Oh, yes," he said, "first you should try to inspire. If you can't inspire them, irritate them. And if you can't irritate them, infuriate them." maybe that says more about me than it does about Benton, I don't know. Now, you can take your time with all this and not be in a hurry. Especially if you've not asked to be a Mitra, especially if you've not asked for ordination, yeah? You'll still be trying and testing people and practices and balancing them with what you think and feel life is all about, what life is really for, yeah? You're testing, the thing with the Kalama Suttas that I meant, the Kalamas earlier that I mentioned, yeah? We're doing that with each other. All the members will do that with you. You do that with all the members. Okay, what are they actually worth? They've got this thing around their neck. What? How do they behave? You know, what are they like? And you know, as I said, we're all messes in progress. So you will meet some older members who you don't sort of really get on with. One's immediate sangha can be uncomfortable, not to say painful at times. And I think you just have to. I mean, I've certainly experienced that in the past. You have to sort of just keep going. In a way, in a certain sense, it's an individual affair in collection with others. Discuss. Through your practice, you begin to build up some trust, some faith, some shraddha in the means and in the people. Once that starts, there's a Tibetan saying, isn't there? Spiritual life, don't start. Start it or better finish it. You can't go back. There's no going back once you've started. How do you forget all this sort of open consciousness? I mean, people do that sometimes. Or maybe more, it's more like they go off and find a better way. I mean, that's great. I mean, if you can find a better way than Tree Ratna, that doesn't involve you compromising yourself and your life, if you can, by all means, change your path with full integrity. Yeah, you don't have to be here and listen to all this stuff. Quite liberating in a way. So why is this relational other regarding stuff so important, if I haven't already sort of pushed it home? There's another little saying that's been with me for a very long time by Chogyam Trungpa, Tibetan teacher who went to the States. He's long dead now. He said something to the effect that we need some objective reference outside ourselves to give us feedback. Yeah. Again, in a way, without that, no means exists. Yeah. We need a spiritual friend or friends who will tell us what we are like. We need to uncover and make conscious our views, our deeply rooted habits, our sanskaras. Yeah. Do we know what we're like? I mean, it's a really interesting question. Never mind other people. If you want to do this on your own, just do I know what I'm really like? How do I come across to other people? What do they make of me? You know, I mean, sometimes with people, you know, you walk towards them, and they sort of go, and you think, oh right, okay, I wonder what that's all about. If you're a reasonably observant, some people aren't observant. They sort of waltz up and splurge all over you anyway, don't they? But that's another story. Subhuti recently came out with this definition of a view, which I rather like. I mean, we tend to think that views, because it's the word view, that it's conscious, yeah, and it's cognitive, and that we've thought it. But it's not really like that at all. Subhuti's definition is, a view is an interpretation, explanation, account, story or myth, expressed or implied, formulated or felt, conscious or unconscious of experience, whether as a whole or in part. Shall I repeat that? Yeah. A view is an interpretation, an explanation, an account, a story or myth, expressed or implied, formulated or felt, conscious or unconscious, and most of them are unconscious, I think, for a long time, of our experience, whether as a whole or in part. So views manifest in our attitudes, behaviour and our reactions. And personally, I've always found my reactions a particularly useful area of manifestation. Yeah. Going back to definitions of greed, hatred and delusion, we can say that our views are an attempt, albeit deeply unconscious, to bring ourselves a sense of security, to prop up our unstable, fragile, teetering egos. Yeah? That's what we do with our views. Yeah? We're not really interested in how things are. We've got some deeply held view, maybe that we picked up from our parents and school, other people, the groups we move in. Yeah. And we prop all that up with all these little sticks, yeah, all these little props. And then one day somebody comes along and says something, out goes a stick, and we feel really upset, angry, we get really in a panic, yeah, we really go off the deep end. One of our little props has been kicked away. So when you experience a reaction, rejoice, yeah, rejoice at reaction. One of your unseen acknowledged props for keeping things how you want them to be or how you think they ought to be has collapsed. Yeah, it's gone. So the whole edifice is sort of tottering. Don't get angry. Don't defend or justify your reaction. Try to identify what the underlying view is. You probably won't be able to do that for yourself. You'll need to talk about it. Again, that's why you need your spiritual friend. When you've calmed down with your objective other, that's why he's important, yeah? When you've calmed down, you can say, well, this is what happened, this is how I felt. What do you think? He can tell you what you're like, yeah? Usually it's painfully obvious to your friends, the people that know you, especially, I'd say, if you live and work with them, yeah? To the extent that you live and work with other members of the Sangha, they know what you're like, yeah? They, you know, you don't have to tell them. They can see exactly through you. It's quite frightening at first until you get used to it. The friend can be objective about what's going on for you. Yeah, you can't. Usually if one's spiritual friends are the least bit observant, as I say, they'll already know what's going on with you. They know what you're like to the extent that you've let them in. You must let them in. You can even preempt reactions, etc., and reveal your wrong views by asking yourself and your spiritual friend all sorts of interesting questions. I mean, I mentioned one or two, didn't I? But there, you can sort of compile a little list. I started off with a list of about 9, but I managed to add some extra ones as well. So I'll see what you make of these. So you ask yourself these questions and you present them to your spiritual friend and say, well, okay, what do you think I'm like with this? What do I rely on for comfort and security? So I've got my own version of that, and then there's what my friends see. Yeah? Again, the closer they are to you, the more time you spend with them, the more intimately you know them, the more obvious it will be to them. Yeah? What do I rely on for comfort and security? What do I think about most often? What's on my mind? Yeah? Again, we may think this isn't very obvious to outsiders, but very often it is. It results in behaviour, doesn't it? So what do I spend my time on? What do I spend my time on? What do I spend my time on when nobody's looking? Yeah. What do I spend my time on when I'm alone? What do I do then? Yeah. What do I talk about most? What do I spend money on? Especially, again, when I'm on my own, when nobody's looking. Yeah. When I'm with my... Do I never spend money with my friend? Do they always buy the burgers or whatever it is? Yeah, that's interesting as well. And they'll know. They'll have an opinion about that. No, you've never bought me anything, kind of thing. They'll know exactly how it is. What's neurotic? How do I behave that is neurotic? Yeah. Where does my neurosis go? What do I put it into? Yeah. What do I escape into? What are my obsessions? What do I get obsessive about? Where does my sense of purpose come from? Am I noticeably changing? Am I? You know, if they've known me for 2 years, have they seen any change in me in 2 years? Am I becoming less selfish? They'll have a very obvious and direct opinion about how selfish I am. What effect do I have on other people? What am I like in groups? I mean, particularly study groups, for instance, but any groups. What do I, you know, am I the life and soul of the party, or am I a wallflower? Do I fade into the wallpaper? What am I like? What are my likes and dislikes? Internal, you know, what do I think I like and dislike? What do other people see as my likes and dislikes? So I suppose, again, the idea is to gently lay all this bare. Yeah? This is spiritual death. Without spiritual death, we don't effectively go for refuge. All of this deeper, more unconscious and hidden stuff can be released with the help of regular recounting of one's life story in various forms. Attila, an older member in London, who's... sort of professional therapist, or he was, he might have retired now, but he used to say that in the movement we drastically underrate telling each other our life stories. Yet sometimes you think, God, this guy's really off the wall, I don't understand him at all. Then he'll tell you what his life is like, and you think, oh, that's why he's like that. Okay, and then you understand, because you can see what they've been through. So it's very revealing in a positive kind of way. It makes you more sort of tolerant of other people when you know what they've been through. On our Going for Refuge retreats here at Padmaloka, we ask men to recount their ethical life story. So, you know, how they learnt about ethics, the sort of ethical sort of situations they came through, what ethics was like in their family, all that kind of stuff, as a sort of life story. Their friendship history, you know, who were their very earliest friends, if any. That can be very revealing as well. Sometimes people, you know, they try to give you a story and you think, God, poor chap, you know, he hasn't ever had a friend in any real meaningful sense. And again, sometimes you think, ah, yeah, the penny drops. That's why he's the way he is. And of course, there's, you know, turning points in their life. We do this on Going for Refuge retreats. Okay, what are the moments in your life when you knew there was more meaning and purpose to life than what you were currently engaged in? What were they like? And that can be very interesting as well. I mean, I know I had one of these sort of turning points when I was probably about 13, 14. I went to secondary school. No, I was at secondary school. That's it. I left secondary school, went to work, and I forgot the whole business for 10 years. I forgot about it completely. I had to go through 10 years of blessed mechanical engineering theory at technical college. And once that fell to bits, I couldn't get on with integral calculus. Once that dropped away, I thought, oh, no, what else? Oh, yeah, what was it I was trying to do 10 years ago? Oh, yeah, meaning and purpose. Suddenly the penny sort of dropped. And, of course, there's confession in the full Buddhist sense, which is, I personally find that incredibly liberating. Ask your group leader about that. I'm running out of time rapidly. So I think all this relational and personal stuff is vital for clearing away some of one's personal mess so that Going for Refuge can grow in intensity and depth. Sometimes it will all feel emotionally overwhelming. Keep going into overwhelm until you get used to it. Yeah, there is no other way. Without that, no means exists. Yeah, keep going into it. What you'll find is that you develop a sort of muscle for it. Slowly, it gets easier. I mean, it's interesting what Dharma Shalin said at the beginning about me being here 30 years. When I first got here, I mean, I'd already noticed this in leading yoga classes. You know, you lead a yoga class, or maybe any class, actually. Probably, I certainly noticed it with yoga classes. You do this quite sort of intimate communication with people. You're talking to them, you're putting stuff out. And then they all go out the door. And it's like, oh, I used to feel bereft at the end of a yoga class. And I'm sure meditation, people who do meditation classes, I know I found that as well. You feel sort of bereft, but gradually you get used to it. And certainly being here, you know, 2 weeks on retreat with people, you go into their life, what's meaningful for them, what's meaningful for you, and they go away. Ugh, you know. And then the next lot coming, you have to do it again and again and again and again, and slowly the muscle gets stronger. Yeah. But as I say, I think that's the only way. That's the only way to do it. All of this deeper, more unconscious and hidden stuff can be released. I've done all that. That's all right. Good. Now, I've not said much, if anything, about how Going for Refuge might bring about a deeper revolution in the world around us. In a way, I've talked about the revolution within. But we're in the world. It affects us. We affect it. Perhaps it's only by bringing about a deeper revolution in ourselves that we can bring about any deeper revolution in the world. If we try to do it in the way I've suggested, the two, self and other, revolutions will unfold simultaneously. And we may discover that, as Padmavendra puts it at the end of his Going for Refuge talks, Going for Refuge is the key to the mystery of existence itself.